This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from KJFK, AM 1230 in Reno, Nevada. And it's Friday. Boy, there's a lot in the news. Let's talk about it with Senator Bernie Sanders, as we have every Friday for lo these many years. Bernie, it's great to have you with us. By the way, let me just mention your... Go ahead.
No, it's just great to be with you, Tom.
Thank you, Bernie. Let me mention your website at sanders.senate.gov and our telephone number, 866-303-2270. And right after the first break, Bernie will be taking your calls. So, call in, get in line. And, Bernie, major theater in the House of Representatives yesterday.
Well, there was. The House Republicans walked out in opposition in support of legislation the president wanted on FISA, which would grant immunity to the telephone companies. The president is making a big deal about this. My colleagues in the Senate, Republicans, have been making a big deal about it. What this gets to the heart of what this is all about, Tom, is really what Bush's philosophy is, and that is we are not a nation of law. We are a nation of people. And the president should have almost unlimited authority to do whatever he wants fighting terrorism. As he defines it to be. And, of course, the way he defines it, it is a never-ending war going on for decades. The issue at point right now is the president, after 9/11, requested that the telephone companies start eavesdropping on large numbers of Americans. And what the president is arguing is because his administration made that request, that regardless of whether or not what the phone companies did was legal or not, they should not be subject to lawsuits from individuals who were spied upon. And I think the precedent there is a horrendous precedent, because to suggest that just because a public official asked somebody in the private sector to do something, whether or not it is legal, whether or not it is constitutional, that person can do it with immunity. And that's the issue here. So I certainly voted against giving immunity to the phone companies. We lost that vote. There is the House, on the other hand, moved in the other direction. And I think as Election Day looms closer, and with the Republican parties having failed in almost every aspect of civil society, whether it's health care, the economy, foreign policy, and so forth, their one trump card is to promote fear in the United States, and to tell people that they are the only party that can protect us, and they will use this as a major point of theater. So that's what we're looking at right now.
And I would submit to you that we ain't seen nothing yet. Wait until we get into the presidential election.
Yeah, no question. I mean, if you look at what's going on in this country, and it's not just me talking, it's poll after poll after poll, people are extremely concerned about an economy in which the middle class is shrinking and poverty is increasing. The latest statistics from the IRS tell us that the upper two-tenths of 1% of Americans earn more income than the bottom 50%. And we're looking at the largest gap between rich and poor of any major country on earth, the highest rate of childhood poverty. If you look at health care, which, of course, the Republicans virtually never talk about, they have nothing to say. And yet, since Bush has been president, 8 million Americans have lost their health insurance. Cost of health care has soared. Study came out. 17,000 Americans every year, Tom, die because they don't have health insurance. We pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. So they can't talk about health care. They can't talk about...
And that's 6/9/11s.
Right. They can't talk about global warming. When in Bali several months ago, the U.S. representative was actually booed because of our reluctance as a government to move forward to address the very, very serious problem of global warming, moving toward energy efficiency and sustainable energy. And I'm on both the Energy and Environmental Committees, and these guys are so, the Bush administration is so in lockstep with the oil companies, with the coal companies, just holding back any progress that we can make in getting the solar industry, the wind industry, geothermal moving, which can not only lower greenhouse gas emissions, but create potentially millions of good-paying jobs as we transform our energy system. But they're tied to fossil fuel companies and their campaign contributions there. So, you know, you name the issue, and they have nothing to say to the American people. So their one trump card is the issue of national security. And I think you will be seeing in a dozen different ways that trump card being played out in the next months until Election Day.
And, you know, the reality of it is that they're really not helping national security. I mean, this war in Iraq has caused the world to hate us, the particularly the way it's been handled, the ham-handed foreign policy of this administration. They've done more to harm national security, I think, than any administration certainly in my life.
Well, I mean, you start off with the assumption that to be effective in fighting terrorism and al-Qaeda, you need an international coalition. And yet in country after country, the United States is now held in lower esteem, lower respect than probably in the history of our country. I was in Morocco 5 or 6 weeks ago, and we talked to the ambassador there. And Morocco is a moderate Muslim country. And this guy, who's a good Republican, said that, well, the last poll they did there, Bush was at 9%. Now, how do you create support within the Muslim world among moderates? How do you create support all over the world to fight al-Qaeda and international terrorism? How do you play a leadership role when your president is held in such low esteem? Not to mention the chaos that is and instability that is now existing in Pakistan, the very difficult problems we are looking in Afghanistan. So I think your point is well taken. I think very few would dispute that the war in Iraq, in terms of our overall national security, in terms of controlling al-Qaeda, has backfired. And what the national intelligence estimate tells us is that al-Qaeda is strong now. They're strong and growing stronger all over the world. So we need to address the very serious problem of international terrorism. We need to do it through the entire global community. What we need to do it with a very different face than Bush has given us. But my point here is, and I think you're going to see this more and more as we come closer to Election Day, is this administration has failed in almost every single area. And they are desperately trying to find the card that can win them back or maintain the White House for them. And I think the theater that you saw yesterday is the card that they will be playing.
Yeah, this is a preview of things to come. I'm curious about your thoughts, Bernie, on how we should be best handling this whole mortgage, subprime mortgage meltdown. There's the international concern now.
Sure.
It is
just another example. You remember a few years ago, Bush was telling us how proud he was that one of his accomplishments that more Americans own their homes. Do you remember that, Tom?
Yeah.
Just a few years ago. Well, he doesn't keep saying, for some reason, I don't know why, he doesn't keep talking about that in the last few months, because we're looking at record-breaking numbers of foreclosures. This is an issue that the Banking Committee, the Senate Banking Committee, is taking a hard look at. They're throwing out different ideas, but clearly it is an issue that has to be dealt with, because it is not only people who have gotten subprime mortgages, but it is now people who have prime mortgages who are having trouble paying off their mortgage. There is now a concern this may spread to student loans. I mean, the reality is that for many people, interest rates are going to be very, very high. Their incomes are incapable of addressing and paying back those loans. And to the degree that they lose their homes, that will lower homes in the community, lower housing values. Then the result of that is that property taxes go down, towns have less communities and less money available to hire police and firemen, and you have this trickle-down impact, which has a very negative impact on our entire economy. So it is an issue that has to get we have to address. We have to make sure that people do not lose their homes because of high adjustable mortgage rates. Mm-hmm. How exactly you do it, I don't know, but it
seems to me that the mortgage industry, the banking industry, has been doing the same thing the health insurance industry has. They've been cherry picking. They've been saying, okay, you know, the health industry, we won't take you if you have a pre-existing condition. We will take you if you're healthy. We'll take your money.
Right.
The mortgage industry has been kind of doing the same thing with this whole credit score thing and everything. And it seems like we need to re-regulate these industries.
There is no question about. And I know every once in a while we get a call on this show, and I hear it in Vermont as well, that people are just outraged by the very high interest rates that they are paying. And that's an issue we are going to work on. The idea that in the United States right now people are paying 25-28% interest rates on their credit cards, for example, is simply unacceptable.
Yeah, it's morally, if not anything
else. It's usury is what it is.
Yeah, exactly. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting from KJFK, AM 1230 here in Reno, Nevada. 16 minutes past Nevada. 16 minutes past the hour. I'll be right back. We'll be right back with you.
Tom Hartman, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
When the paycheck just ain't stretching like it might have once before, 'cause good jobs are all gone, left you in some big box store. Between food and rent and medicine, seems the suit's frayed a little bit more. When the boss is cut to that last corner, they walk out of those doors. When the truckers hauling sweatshop stuff won't stop there anymore. When the folks won't cross your pickets, 'cause their boat's the same as yours. That is one big union.
We've got some problems here in this country. We've got to solve them. 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie Hour, on the line with us. His website, sanders.senate.gov, ours, tomhartman.com, airamerica.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, participate in our blog. And Bernie, ready for some phone calls?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Joe in Los Angeles, California, listening on K-Talk. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, good morning. Senator Sanders, it's a pleasure. My question is two parts. First of all, in regards to the FISA vote, isn't the immunity for the telecoms, I mean, isn't what this really is about is George Bush is really concerned because it means it would vindicate his wrongdoing and protect him from prosecution? I mean, isn't that what this is really about? And isn't it really apparent to all of you on both sides of the aisle that that's what's really going on here? Or is that just a myth in the media?
Well, I think it's certainly part of what's going on. Obviously, if somebody goes to court and the court says, yes, the phone companies acted illegally and unconstitutionally, well, guess who made that order? That was at the request of George W. Bush. So your point is well taken. The other point that some have been made is that obviously Bush is far more concerned about the financial well-being of phone companies than he is about the Constitution and the needs of the American people as well. So your point is well taken.
Yeah. Glenn in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Glenn, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. I am a union organizer with the SEIU, and here's my question for you. What do you think the odds of passing the Employee Free Choice Act is after we have a new president?
I would say the odds are excellent after we have a new president. Obviously, we had the votes in the House. We had the votes in the Senate. We have a majority of the votes, but Republicans filibustered that bill. And in case people don't understand what that bill is about, right now, at a time when millions of workers are working longer hours for lower wages, we're losing our jobs because companies are shutting down and moving to China and other low-wage countries. We're losing union membership, not because workers do not want to join a union, but because it is almost impossible under the current National Labor Relations Board rulings, which are very pro-employer, for workers to be able to do so. And the Employee Free Choice Act would allow a card checkoff that if 50% of the workers in an agency plus one choose to join a union, they will have that union. That's something that exists in other countries around the world. It is something that we desperately need. We have the votes right now in the House. We have the votes in the Senate. But we don't have the 60 votes that we need in the Senate to end the Republican filibuster. And certainly Bush would veto that bill in 3 seconds. But both major Democratic candidates, Clinton and Obama, are supportive of this legislation. And I, the Democratic president will test that.
Ah, and
but that's a big deal. That's a big deal.
From your lips to God's ears, Bernie. Roger in Rhode Island, you're on the air.
Hi, pleasure to talk to you again. My question is the fact that the Qwest Telecoms did not participate in the illegal wiretapping. I'm sure that he testified that the request was made as early as March of 2001. Well,
yeah, this started before 9/11.
Right,
the illegal wiretap program.
Yeah. Wondering if the if that wouldn't put more arrows in the quiver of the legal beagles as far as going after George Bush.
Well, the answer is yes. I mean, and the point is that if Qwest had a sense that their lawyers told them that it would be illegal for them to participate in this program, where was Verizon and AT&T and the other companies? And so I think that is a very good point. It was, here is a very clear instance where one company said, excuse me, Mr. President or Mr. Attorney General, you may want us to do it. It's illegal. We do not commit illegal acts. So then the question that you're asking is, why did not the other companies act the same way? And that is a very good question.
Yeah. Just a minute before the break here. Bob in Brooklyn, New York, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, thank you. Hello, Senator Sanders.
Hi.
I have a question about health care. Now, I pay my own insurance myself, my own private policy. In the last year, my premiums went up 30%. Now, I don't understand. I've heard all the interviews and the debates between Senator Clinton and Senator Obama. Both of them say their plans would control the cost of health care. You know, if there is universal or some government or national health care plan, if everybody is covered, the cost of the insurance itself is astronomical. You know, we hear about an MRI costs $5,000. How would either the Clinton or the Obama plan, if it's enacted, reduce the cost of the medical care itself?
Well, Bob, it is not necessarily true that just because you add more people into health care, the costs are automatically going to go up. Right now, we have 47 million uninsured. We spend twice as much per person on health care as any other nation. And almost all of the industrializations, all of them cover all of their people. Maybe this is a question, Tom, that we can pursue after the break.
Okay, we'll pick it up on the other side of the break. Thank you, Bernie. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program right here on Air America Radio. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line taking your calls. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Broadcasting today from KJFK, AM 1230, AM with IQ, here in Reno. Tom Hartman with you. Our program brought to you by all of the sponsors you hear on our local and local stations and our network, as well as SEIU 1199, 200,000 health and hospital workers working for quality, affordable health care protection for all Americans, because health care in these United States should be a right and not a privilege. And apropos to that, Bernie, you were answering a question before about how a national health care program, whether it's Hillary Clinton's or Barack Obama's or some variation in between or whatever, might actually end up costing us a lot.
Bob asked, but on the surface seems like a sensible question. Hey, cost of health care is soaring right now. If you add more people into health care plans, isn't that going to just drive rates up even higher? And the answer is no. The truth of the matter is that compared to every other major country on Earth, all of which provide health care to all of their people, we spend twice as much per person on health care as do any of these other countries.
Yeah, and it's literally twice as much.
Literally twice as much. That is the real number. I think Canada is second. We spend almost three times what they do in the UK. And the reason is that our health care system is not designed to provide quality health care to all people in a cost-effective way. Our system, as you mentioned a moment ago, is designed to make profits for the insurance companies. It is designed to make profits for the drug companies. So if you have a system that does not waste hundreds of billions of dollars in administration, in bureaucracy, in companies telling people that they're not covered when they thought they were covered, coming up with incredible concepts like pre-existing conditions. Oh, yes, we can't cover you because you had breast cancer 10 years ago, and beyond comprehension, why do you get insurance if not to get coverage? We have companies picking and choosing who they will cover rather than saying we're going to cover all people. So to answer Bob's question, what study after study does show is that you have a simple universal program which guarantees health care to all people as a right, you can administer that program far more cost-effectively than the disaster that we currently have. You can provide quality health care to all people without spending more than we're currently spending. Also, there must necessarily be a much greater emphasis on disease prevention, on primary health care. I had a hearing on the Health Education Labor Committee earlier this week making the point that in rural areas all over America, we don't have enough doctors. We don't have enough dentists. When people get sick, they can't even find a health practitioner to go to. This is in the United States in the year 2008, because we are not primarily interested in quality health care for all. We are primarily interested in profits for the insurance companies and the drug companies.
Yeah, and the one thing that we'll be missing from our system if we go to a universal program is William McGuire, the CEO, ex-CEO of the second largest health insurance company in the United States. The one thing that we'll be missing is William McGuire's $1.78 billion paycheck.
And maybe what might be missing are all the TV ads telling you which drugs you should buy or which...
Yeah.
Coronary unit in a hospital you should go to.
Right, and the private jets with the gold-plated bathrooms for the executives of the health insurance companies. Anyhow, Joan in Montana, listening on KMPT, one of our newest affiliates in Missoula, Montana, is on the line with a question for you. Bernie, hey, Joan.
Hi, I'm real happy to hear you're going to be coming to Missoula next month, too.
I think it's the 28th of March. I'll be there.
I'll be there, too. I have a question about the loans, and I wanted to ask him, Bernie, if I have a wrong impression of what's going on with the subprime loans. One of the things that happened was that a lot of people didn't make their payments, but there's a lot of people who did. And my understanding is that they told these people when their loans were, they were called them due, that they, because they changed the credit ratings on how they applied for a loan, that these people no longer qualified to refinance, so therefore they lost their homes. They also weren't allowed short sales. And I'm just wondering also, all these companies that were supposedly went defunct, were they purchased by some of the bigger conglomerate loan companies who bought up all these loans and then went through the process of picking and choosing and not allowing these people a chance, even though they gave them a loan the first time, telling them, sorry, you no longer qualify because we changed our
credit? Well, John, I don't know, to be honest with you, all of the answers to the first part of your question, but I do know the answer to the second, and that is yes. We know of many instances where people can't even locate the company that owns their mortgage because it was sold and sold again to larger and larger entities. So the second part of your question is real. What is also absolutely certain is we have a crisis today which may get larger, and it is an issue that the Congress has got to address.
Charles calling from Kentucky. Hey, Charles, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Gentlemen, maybe one or both of you can update me as to the status of what's going on with the Red Dogs, our longest-serving unit at the time in Iraq.
And you're talking about Marine Unit 773, I think they are, aren't they?
Well, them also. There are actually a few units, I understand, that have been sent back. Of receiving their full educational benefits, and I was hoping that Senator Sanders could give me some insight.
Tom, are you more on top of that than
I am? I don't have at the tip of my fingers any of the details on this, Bernie. I know that it's been an ongoing and festering problem. The expert on this is Larry Scott, who runs VAWatchdog.org, and he's our expert on all things military. He comes on the show every other week, and I'll be sure to ask him.
I apologize for not having the details on that. All that I can tell you is that a number of us are supporting legislation introduced by Senator Jim Webb of Virginia, which calls for a new GI Bill of Rights. The feeling is that the first GI Bill of Rights after World War II had just a huge impact, not only on the men and women who served, but on the whole country. It gave us a well-educated generation of workers who had a significant impact in improving the standard of living of all people, and we are looking at something like that right now.
Yeah, and a fine thing it is. Danny in Los Angeles, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Mr. Sanders. My question is this. There's an investigation going on into Major League Baseball using my taxpayer money, and I want to know why that investigation is not going through the owners and the general managers and the trainers, and why it's only focusing on the players, and the owners have profited greatly by the steroids thing, and they turned a blind eye in interest of making huge profits because they're hitting home runs, you know, breaking records.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. This is an industry, too, that's exempt from antitrust legislation,
yeah,
if my recollection is correct.
Yes.
Thank you,
Dan. Well, there are a whole lot of issues regarding professional baseball. I would start off that, you know, there has been some concern. I'm not, obviously, that was a hearing done in the House Government Reform Committee. I'm in the Senate, so I don't know all of the details, although I used to be a member of that committee when I was in the House. I think the argument for the hearing is that if it is true that Major League ballplayers and stars and Hall of Famers are using steroids and other performance-enhancing drugs, it really sends a message to millions of kids in this country that using those types of drugs is okay. Because if the best in the country can do it, why can't some kid in high school? And that's certainly something we do not want to see. But I think the point of the question is, what is the responsibility of the owners? Did the owners turn a blind eye to what, as I understand it, below the current, everybody knew was going on?
Yeah.
I think the caller is right. I mean, that takes you even to the whole broader question of professional athletics in America, the fact that most of these teams, whether it's in the NFL or in Major League Baseball, are owned by billionaires. And meanwhile, to get into the ballpark, I was just talking to a friend of mine, to get into the ballpark, whether it's Fenway Field or any place else, you know, if you're a husband, wife, and two kids go, that's more than the average working family can afford.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, these major league teams have received antitrust exemptions. And I just think that's really not right. You know,
I think we should break the whole thing up and go back to the Green Bay Packers model. You know, let the community own the club and sell stock in it they made it illegal. It's got to be individuals. It's absolutely
really
bizarre.
I mean, you know, baseball is, you know, everybody loves baseball. Everyone's excited about the Super Bowl.
It's a national sport.
We had this phenomenon where the NFL even wanted to exclude people. You know, I live in Vermont, where I live, clearly part of New England. We could not have gotten even to see the first Giant New England Patriot game on TV because they wanted to even make more money out of it. So, you know, taking a hard look at professional athletics, which, by the way, have received in one way or another huge amounts of public support, not only in terms of antitrust legislation and exemptions, but also in building and constructing their ballparks.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's maybe a discussion for another time.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you, Bernie. Ken in East Rutherford, New Jersey. We have about a half a minute here, Ken, before the break. A quick one?
Yes. Thanks for taking my call. I'm concerned about the outsourcing of the jobs into foreign countries, Levi's went to Mexico, laid off all the people, and the people that have got laid off aren't paying Social Security, and that the manufacturers are making their jeans in the Mexico and shipping them back to.
Right. Well, so, Ken, you should be.
My question.
All right, let's take that one at the.
Yeah. What's Congress doing about this? Yeah, we'll pick that up on the other side of the break.
Okay.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Sanders.Senate.gov is website. Our website, TomHartmann.com, if you want to drop into the live chat room and say hi. Or AirAmerica.com for our blog. Sam is running the blog there on the homepage. 45 minutes past the hour.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
We wake up each morning and start every day with coffee, espresso, and grande lattes. Racing the traffic and bitch while we wait. Pissed at the world for making us late. We punch and then lunch it, then punch out again. Rush home to clean up the messes we left. Microwave dinner, then put it to bed. Tomorrow we'll do
better than that. And we are. We're all working here to make it to make America better than that. 9.5 minutes before the hour, it's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And I'm broadcasting live today from KJFK, AM 1230 in Reno, Nevada. I'm pretty sure. Hey, Bernie, you were about to answer a question.
Right, well, Ken asked the very important question about outsourcing, which has affected millions of American workers whose jobs have gone to low-wage countries, China, Mexico, elsewhere. And many of those workers are now working at jobs that pay 50 or 60% of what they previously had. And it is a huge issue, and it is tied into our entire trade policy, which is pushed by corporate America, who loves the idea that they can have the freedom of throwing American workers out on the street, moving abroad, and then bringing their products back into this country tariff-free. I wish I could give Ken better news, other than to say there is growing support in Congress against unfettered free trade and for a trade policy which is based on the interests of working people in the middle class rather than the CEOs of large corporations. We are gaining support. But there's no question we still have a long way to go in the Senate and the House. But every time there's an election, you see people going out into the real world, you see them changing their tune. And you're seeing that both Clinton and Obama are now speaking increasingly in an increasingly critical way about our current trade policies. But bottom line, Ken is touching on a very, very important point. If we're going to grow the middle class and eliminate poverty, you're going to need to change our trade policies so the companies start investing in this country and not just in China.
Yeah. Oh, man, I was so pleased to hear Barack Obama in particular. I haven't heard Senator Clinton specifically condemn NAFTA, but Obama did day before yesterday, and I thought, wow. You know, he's
got to look at the details. I mean,
yeah,
the devil in all of these things is in the details. What do we mean by workers' rights and environmental standards? Bottom line is our entire trade policies have worked to benefit the large multinationals at the expense of working people.
Yeah, tragically. Roger in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with from WPTT. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, Tom, help me with the wording of my question. About 2 weeks ago, we wanted to ask you, when a candidate drops out of the presidential race, what do they do with their money, sir?
A candidate drops out of a presidential race. You know, Roger, I'm not 100% sure. When you drop out of a congressional race, there are limits. You certainly can't put it in your pocket, that's for sure. You can give it to the political party. You can give it to other candidates. My guess is you probably can give it to nonprofit organizations. But you certainly can't put it in your pocket. So I don't know definitively the answer to your question, but I suspected something like that.
So, or if that person was a member of the House or the Senate, they could roll that money into their next campaign?
Oh, that you could do, too. Yes,
yeah.
You could use it for political purposes. You could do that, too, yes.
Okay, great. Bill in Los Angeles. Hey, Bill, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Senator Sanders, the banks are really doing a number on the consumer. Why not reinstitute the tax deduction for consumer credit that existed back in the 70s, or in the alternative, some type of a tax credit for the usurious money that the banks are collecting when they're, in essence, lending out money that they paid the government 5% for up to 30%?
Yeah, I remember when I used to be able to deduct all kinds of interest, if I remember correctly.
Well, I think that's what Bill is talking about,
yeah.
And I think that's something that we should take a hard look at. But the bottom line is that ever since the Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional the ability of the government to control interest rates, what we have seen is not only interest rates soaring, but above and beyond that, you have seen all kinds of fees, late fees and this fee and that fee, and these banks are making huge profits from that source of revenue as well. So I think that the time is very long overdue for the Congress to take a very hard look at the ripoff practices of these banks and start protecting consumers. The question, of course, is, you know, would Bush veto any significant piece of consumer legislation? I guess he would, but we've got to go forward in any case.
Indeed. Juan in New York City, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Oh, hi, Tom. Hi, Senator.
Hi.
I had a question about who in Congress or what group of members of Congress are up to overseeing the financial crisis. and whether you expect there to be some cooperation with the administration. And just to dramatize it, it just seems like a huge systemic crisis, you know, sort of like dominoes falling, you know, instead of in theory, in practice. And yeah, Paul Krugman had this wonderful column today where he connected the crisis in auction rate securities with the subprime crisis. And I know both the securities, and I could never see it coming. I still don't understand why no one shows up for these auctions the way they used to. But it just seems like we have a problem that's as big as the one that we had in the 30s.
Yeah, we got a huge problem. And to answer your question, the committees that deal with it, I think most, you know, sometimes you have overlapping jurisdiction, but I think the major committee will be the banking committee, which is chaired in the Senate by Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut, and the Financial Services Committee in the House, which is chaired by Bonnie Frank of Massachusetts. And I
both
know
good
that,
men.
Yeah, and Dodd had a hearing with Bernanke, with Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, and others, just to try to begin to get a handle on the issue. But I talked to Dodd on this, and I think there's going to be some very aggressive legislation, at least coming out of that committee, to begin addressing this crisis.
Bernie, we just have a couple seconds left. Your thoughts on Mr. Bernanke these days?
Too little, too late. But, I mean, clearly we're going to have to work together to get this economy revitalized.
Yeah, indeed. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website. He's got a great newsletter over there as well. Check it out. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Always great having you on. It's Anything Goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls on any topic you want to talk about, as well as the news of the day, right after this, 57 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative con. This is the Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. The Port Authority of New Jersey, of New York and New Jersey, saw the interest rate that they're paying on money that they're borrowing jump from 4.3% to 20% last week. This is starting to happen to municipalities, to schools, to public institutions. All across the country. Paul Krugman writing about it today in the New York Times. The deal is that there are these all these new financial instruments. You know, Kevin Phillips' most recent, actually his two most recent books, really deal with the fact that the Kevin Phillips, by the way, the guy who wrote The Coming Republican Majority back in the 60s, as I recall, maybe it was 71 or 72 that he wrote that book, and predicting essentially the Reagan, the so-called Reagan Revolution, and he was right, and the reasons that he talked about were right. Kevin Phillips, a very 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 wise guy. I mean that, you know, as a compliment. He's a very wise observer of the scene, and he has pointed out in his last two books that we have gone from a country that makes things and thus produces value to being a country that basically says, do you want fries with that? You know, that I'll do something for you if you'll do something for me. And, you know, it's a little circle that just doesn't work all that well, because nobody's actually creating wealth. You know, I'll wash your car if you'll mow my lawn. Well, you know, that's fine. But at the end of the day, where's the wealth in any of that? There's got to be something that is created that has value. Typically, that's called manufacturing. Whether it's manufacturing cars out of steel, making the steel out of iron ore, you know, taking the iron ore out of the ground, like they do in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and my brother-in-law used to be the captain of one of the ships that would haul that stuff back and forth. In fact, I think he still is working on Lake Superior. Whether it's that, or whether it's making something out of our minds, you know, creating software, for example, things like that. This is all manufacturing, essentially. As opposed to the so-called service sector, the so-called service business that was supposed to help us. And what has happened is that increasingly our economy has come to be based, particularly since the Reagan Revolution, A, declared war on the American worker, and B, not only green-lighted with Reagan's and Bush Sr.'s fast-track authority and special trade deals and all these kinds of things, and then Bill Clinton with NAFTA and GATT and the WTO, and now with George Bush Jr. On steroids with this stuff, basically said to corporations, it's not just free trade. Hey, you can just move jobs overseas. You don't have to pay Social Security tax. You don't have to worry about paying health care. They'll work a whole lot cheaper. You can simply make that stuff someplace else. And that's where the wealth happens to be being created, not here. And so as a result of this, to step into the void, what we've got is basically people selling money to each other. It's not just, I'll wash your car if you'll mow my lawn. It's now, I'll loan you $100 if you'll loan me $100. And gee, it seems like we both made $100. But we didn't. And this is what's happening with these auctions that Paul Krugman is talking about. And the without going into all the excruciating details of it, they're called auction rate securities. And it's just it's a new financial instrument, a slick way of doing this, and of trying to raise money. See, back in the old days, they used to just sell bonds. They'd go out into the public and they'd say, "We want to borrow money, and we'll give you an incentive to loan us the money. You won't have to pay local taxes on it," for example, or state or federal taxes if it's a federal bond. And they would sell debt. They would borrow money. But now it's in order to get the price down and create an instrument that's supposed to be as good as cash. What they've been doing is they've been selling these auctionable securities that get continuously recycled. I'll loan you $100 if you'll loan me $100. And last week, you know, it's like the old Country Joe and the Fish song. You know, what if they gave a war and no one came? Remember that from way back from the 60s? Well, what if they gave an auction and no one came? It happened. And now it's spreading to things like student loans. I mean, it's just spreading right across. This could be a tipping point, and a very, very destructive and dangerous one. And what we're seeing is the direct consequence of the insane economic policies put into place by the Reagan administration that in part were proactive. In part they were saying, okay, we're going to create systems that make it more profitable. We're actually going to give tax breaks to companies to move jobs offshore, overseas. We're going to create systems that make it more profitable for big transnational corporations to do business and make it more profitable for their CEOs, and to hell with the workers, and so they were somewhat proactive. And then B, they were also relatively passive, in as much as what they were doing is they were taking apart the regulations that have been there since the Great Depression to prevent another Great Depression. The regulations of the banking industry that said, no, there are some things you can do and some things you can't. The regulation of the home mortgage industry. You had 3-4 years ago in the Bush administration, several members of the administration showing up for a much ballyhooed press conference where they were going to do away with regulations on the mortgage industry. And one guy comes in with a chainsaw and another comes in with a pair of hedge clippers. Yeah, we're going to cut the red tape. Well, they cut the red tape, all right. And what that meant was that that when you went to get a mortgage for your home and you're signing that 16-page fine print document, nobody anymore has to tell you that in paragraph 17, line 4, buried in the type, it says, oh, and by the way, if you try and pay this loan off early, you have to pay an extra $10,000 penalty. Prepayment penalties. Or, oh, by the way, after 3 years, if your credit score changes, which is pretty capricious these days, we could jack the interest rate up on you, even more than what we told you we could jack it up on you, et cetera, et cetera. It's just, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. And this is this is the cancer stage of capitalism. That is what we have arrived at. I heard a talk show host yesterday say he was a capitalist, and he was proud to be a capitalist. And I thought, I wonder if he actually is. Most people... You know, arguably, many of us are capitalists in some small way, because a capitalist, by definition, is somebody who takes their money and invests in something that's capital, traditionally a business, and then sits back and gets passive income from it. And most of us have some investments. And so, you could argue that in some ways we're tiny capitalists. But, you know, a real capitalist is somebody who is making their living exclusively, by and large, with money. money is capital. Right? They're out there, they're taking money, and they're making money with money. And, in fact, under the last Bush tax cut, they said, hey, if you're a working stiff, if you make a paycheck, you're going to pay the top tax rate in the 30%, in the low 30s. And on top of that, you're going to have to pay FICA, you're going to have to pay for Social Security, you're going to have to pay for Medicare, you're going to have all these taxes, plus you're going to have to pay sales taxes and car registration taxes and tax. And so if you're a working guy, I mean, you may end up being paying 35, 40, 45, 50% of your income in taxes, depending on where you live and all the taxes in state and federal and everything else and all the fees and things that are taxes. But if you're a capitalist, in other words, if you sit around, if the way that you earn your living is by sitting around on your butt, sitting around the pool on your butt, waiting for the dividend checks to arrive, or selling the investments that you've made, you don't have to pay any of that nasty Social Security stuff and Medicare stuff, and the top tax rate that you're going to have to pay, if you're Warren Buffett, who protests this, by the way, to his credit, is 15%. That's the top tax rate. That's how dysfunctional and broken and distorted and twisted this system has become. And what's even more bizarre is that when that law was passed, dropping the top income tax rate on dividend and interest income down to 15%, I'll bet you most Americans don't even know it happened. I bet if you walked up to 100 people on the street, 95 of them would say, I don't know what you're talking about. Special tax breaks for venture capitalists, for VC firms, special tax breaks for Warren Buffett, special tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, but not for working people. No, I didn't know about that. It's right there in the tax code. There has been this whole get-rich-quick mentality that came along with the greed is good 80s of the Reagan era. This change from we're all in it together, there's the commons, this is a country that we all love and we're working to build, and the American dream is that you can get a job where you can put your kids through school and buy a home and a car and live the middle class life. That was the American dream. That got scratched off, and instead the dream was maybe someday I'll hit the lottery. We'll be back with your call 16 minutes past the hour.
Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocky was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Welcome back, Anything Goes Friday. Tom Hartman Radio Program brought to you by our sponsors. Please patronize them. And please let them know you're listening, including SEIU 1199, 200,000 health and hospital workers suggesting that health care should be a right, not just suggesting, asserting, demanding that health care should be a right, not a privilege in these here United States of America. We're broadcasting live today from KJFK, AM 1230 in Reno. We're at the book signing tonight from 5 to 7 here in Reno at Borders Books and Music. That's in South Virginia for our local listeners in the Redfield Promenade Shopping Center. So I look forward to seeing you there. Should be a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to it. And 22 minutes past the hour. Enough of my ranting. Let's get on with our Anything Goes Friday theme, as it were. Mike in New York City. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind today? Mike, you are on the air. Oh, Mike is no longer on the air. Okay, let's go to Mark, and let's flip back to the other side of the country. Mark in Los Angeles. Hey, Mark, what's on your mind today?
Hey, good morning, Tom. First of all, it's a tremendous honor to talk to you. I find you to be one of the best educated and informed guys in media today, so I'm looking to your take on a couple of questions here quickly. With the political showboat that the House Republicans pulled yesterday of storming out of the chamber, did that not leave a quorum on the floor that they could have then acted upon things such as Kucinich's bill for impeachment or any other agenda that the Democrats wanted to get through? Did they have enough members there to move?
They did. And at the time, I didn't know what the rules were for a quorum, and so I was questioning that yesterday in the air. I'm not sure if they had a quorum or not. They did. And, in fact, they did pass without the Republicans. And if you hang on just a second here, I think I can actually get the numbers on this thing. They passed a contempt citation against, you know, what's her name?
Myers.
Yeah, Harriet Myers and John Bolton, or Josh Bolton, rather, for not showing up before Congress. And that's, you know, that was a pretty big deal. I mean,
well, that was the thing that basically drove them out, because they didn't want to address the FISA reform, correct?
That's right, yeah. And well, yes and no. They didn't want to address the FISA reform, and they didn't want there to be a vote on the contempt citation. And they ended up having, with the FISA reform, you know, the House didn't, as far as I know, do what they should have done. But in fact, this new piece of legislation, although they haven't passed the Senate's legislation, I guess that's the good news. But with regard to the contempt citations, they held them, and a fine thing it is. Thanks a lot for the call, Mark. Great to hear from you. Jim, is it Genoa or Genoa, Nevada?
That's Jim in Genoa, Nevada. Good morning. How
okay.
are you?
Hey, Jim. I'm great. What's up?
Good. Hey, listen, I'm anxious to know how many times we have to or are able to ask our Shrub Bush and his cohorts about his crying wolf and not taking him to task for it.
Well, this is, you know, the theatrics that the Republicans pulled yesterday in the House of Representatives. I hope the Democrats are paying attention. I mean, this is not new. Obviously, Newt Gingrich turned it into an art form back in the day, but it is something that the Democrats need to be doing. They need to be pointing this stuff out. And every time the fear mongering happens, there should be some sort of a balloon that they let off or something. You know, it's or a shriek or something. You know, the danger, of course, to that is that there probably will at some point in time be something happening someplace, you know, God forbid, but who knows, you know, some kind of attack in the United States or some crazies or whatever. And, you know, then, you know, you don't want to be making fun of it. But the fact, you're absolutely right. And the two ways that you motivate people, and Jim, thanks a lot for the call. The two ways that you can motivate people are by moving them toward pleasure or moving them away from pain. I mean, that's it. There's nothing else. And you do it with information, you do it with emotion, you do it with data, you do it with all the various tools that you do. But the Bush administration for the last 8 years or 7 years and change has been all about moving away from pain. Scare, 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 scare. And they're still doing it. And the Republicans are still doing it. And the reason that they are doing this is because they know that if they talked about their real agenda, which is economic, their real agenda, which is power for a very elite few, economic and political power, principally economic power, but that translates into political power. If they talked about their real agenda, nobody would vote for them. I mean, back after the Republican Great Depression of 1929, 1930, everybody saw the Republican Party for what they were. And, you know, most of the people who were around back then now are no longer with us, and they don't remember. We've lost our institutional memory. David in Alameda, California. Hey, David, got about a minute here before this break. What's up?
Good day, Tom. I'm curious. With all the bread and circuses that Congress seems to throw as, you know, steroids and baseball use, whatever happened to the investigation into where that anthrax came from Fort Detrick, Maryland?
Good question, David. And it's never been investigated to the best of my knowledge, and I'm astounded that it hasn't. Not seriously. I mean, you know, the responsibility for the investigation was with Alberto Gonzalez and is now with Mr. Mukasey. And apparently they've decided that this is just nothing worth bothering with. After all, you know, this was just before the Patriot Act was passed. You had only two men in the United States Senate who could have stopped it because Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party. Control of the Senate went to the Democrats. And so Pat Leahy could have stopped the Patriot Act as chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, because that's the committee it originated in. He could have stopped it. And Tom Daschle, as the leader of all the Democrats in the Senate and the guy who set the Senate schedule, could have stopped it by not bringing it up for a vote. And guess who the only two people in Washington, D.C., or the only two politicians who got anthrax were? Tom Daschle and Pat Leahy. And so I would submit to you that A, that's not a coincidence, and B, the fact that the Bush administration, the Justice Department, has done zero investigation of it is not a coincidence either. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Tom Hartman here, broadcasting live today from Reno, KJFK, AM 1230. I remember 1968, I think it was. I was 17 years old, hitchhiking across the country, and got arrested for hitchhiking in Reno. And every time I see Reno 911 on TV, I don't think that was the same police department. Anyhow, welcome back. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. They just ran us out of town back then, you know, let's take you to the city limit and drop you off. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. As a lifelong loyal Michigan Democrat, after hearing our Senator Carl Levin this morning vigorously defend that farce of a Michigan primary we had, yeah. I feel like the title of one of your books, Rude.
Yeah, I get it, Bernice. How, any suggestions or any thoughts? I mean, you're a Michigander. You're living there in Dearborn in the Detroit area. Any thoughts on how we can help the Michigan and the Florida Democratic parties encourage them, I guess would be the word, to put together caucuses so that the people of those states can actually make their voice known, their thoughts and preference known?
Well, I left messages with the governor's office, with Senator Levin's office, and with Howard Dean's office.
Mm-hmm.
And my suspicion is that the fix is in for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, I'm not. Unfortunately, it's going to look that way, whether it is that way or not, because her name was essentially the only name now.
Right.
You know, or let me rephrase that. Barack Obama's name was not on the ballot at the time, nor was John Edwards.
And Edwards also.
Right. And so in Michigan, anyway, both of them, I don't recall the situation in Florida. I think everybody's name was on the ballot in Florida, but it just didn't count. And in both states, there should be a process where everybody counts. And if those two states were to get their act together and say, okay, we're going to hold a caucus, say the second week of May, and, you know, a party can put it together. It's going to cost them a little bit of money, but they've got some cash. And you can't have another primary because that involves the government and it's expensive and the state isn't going to do it and the legislature would have to appropriate funds and they're not going to do that just for the Democratic Party, et cetera, et cetera. But the parties could do caucuses and they absolutely should. And I know that the conventional wisdom, I guess, is that a caucus favors Barack Obama over Hillary Clinton. I've seen that trend, but I don't believe that there's anything intrinsic about a caucus that favors, you know, a particular candidate over another particular candidate beyond the preference of the people showing up. I mean, that's the bottom line. And in fact, you know, the first in the country is Iowa, which is a caucus. So let's have caucuses in Michigan and Florida. And Bernice, thanks for calling and raising the issue. I appreciate it. And let me encourage all of our listeners who are in Florida and Michigan. We're on the air in a number of radio stations in these states. All of our callers who are listening in those states to contact your local elected Democrats because they have a lot of power with the party. They really do. Whether it's your member, if you have a Democrat representing you in the House of Representatives or the Senate in the state, or whether you have a Democrat representing you in the House of Representatives, the Federal House of Representatives, or your United States Senators, contact their offices. Contact the governor's office. In Florida, it won't have quite so much impact because it's a Republican, but you have a Democratic governor in Florida. Contact her office and say, hey, you know, we would like to have a caucus in this state so that we can express our preference. And frankly, I would think that supporters of Hillary Clinton would, as well as Barack Obama, but I would think that a supporter of Hillary Clinton would want that to be the case, too, so that there's not the perception that somehow she or her campaign are trying to, you know, pull off something. That's the last thing that any candidate wants is that perception, because it's going to taint them all the way up to the convention, and frankly, all the way to November, to the general election. So it just seems like the best thing for everybody. Bottom line. Dave in Los Angeles. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I'm glad to hear you're going to Missoula. That's where my sister is, and I told her already to go see your thing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's a great town. It's a town I've not been to before, and I'm really looking forward to it. There's not a lot of places I haven't been.
I'll put in a plug. She's the postcard lady. Buy some postcards while you're at the bookstore.
Okay, I'll do it.
So, any rate, what I wanted to get to is you're so spot on with your rant on the economics and what's going on. But I'd like to refine a few things. One, real quickly, is that we're all expected now to become capitalists as we get older, especially in retirement.
Yeah.
And
the rules are somewhat different. You know, if you have money in retirement funds, then the rules on taxation in many cases for taking that out are different than the rules for, you know, Warren Buffett right now.
They were. And this is the thing I wanted to get into real quick is the art of any good flim-flam is to take something with a great reputation, a solid reputation, change it structurally, and introduce a huge amount of risk and sucker people into buying it. And we've seen this time and time again, the SNL crisis. We've seen it with the mortgage-backed securities. Those were solid investments previously.
Right.
And now there's another one which you brought up, and your audience really needs to know that municipal bonds are in dire circumstances. It's terrible what's going to happen here.
Yeah.
And this is the auctions which you talked about. There were no buyers for muni bonds at two auctions on Tuesday. Never happened before.
Right. And the entire this is sort of like, you know, the banking crisis of 1931, 32, 33, in part it had nothing to do with the banking system. It had to do with people's perception of the banking system. It had to do with the fact that people freaked out and said that they'd rather have their dollars under their mattress than in the bank's vault. And the banks, of course, didn't have the dollars in their vaults. They had them on paper. And so you had this run on the banks. And this was basically a run on the bonds. And you're absolutely right. And again, you can track it back. Just like with the Republican SNL crisis, this is the Republican it spreads right across the board. The whole Republican economic crisis that is I don't even want to call it the Bush recession. People have suggested we should call it the Bush recession, the second big Bush recession, because you recall Bush Senior had a big recession too. But this could be the Bush. This could be the Republican Great Depression of the 1980s, and it's a really scary thing. And spot on, David. Thanks for pointing it out. I appreciate the call, Evelyn in Reno. Hey, Evelyn, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Welcome to Reno, and I'll be seeing you tonight.
Wonderful. Thank you.
I would like your listeners to join me in emailing Harry Reid and telling him that he should schedule these Republican filibusters for 7 o'clock at night or on the weekends, so that they can't go out and do their fundraising. They can't deal with the lobbyists and get the checks.
Yeah.
There's nothing better than getting between a Republican and their money.
You're absolutely right, Evelyn. And this is what, you know, Bernie Sanders has been calling for that on this show for months now. He's been saying, he's not quite as combative about it as I am, because he has to work and live with Harry Reid. But I think that he's absolutely right, and others, you know, members of the House, of course, are just outraged about this. Why is it that when the Republicans want to say, okay, you don't have 60 votes, you've only got 59 votes on this thing, which is a clear majority. There's 100 seats in the Senate, right? You've only got 59 votes on this thing, and so with our 41 votes, which is, you know, I mean, they actually have more Republicans than that, but in some cases, that's what it comes down to. We're going to call a filibuster, and Harry Reid just says, okay, we're pulling the legislation. You know,
yeah, I hate
like,
that.
Like this gentleman thing. Instead of saying, okay, damn it, have your filibuster, start talking. And, you know, and keep talking, because when you stop talking, your filibuster's over, and we're going to hold the vote. And I just, Harry Reid is a brilliant guy and a great politician. I have a lot of respect for him on a lot of levels, but I just don't get it why he's not doing this, why he's not doing political theater against the Republicans the way that they have done against the Democrats so effectively so many times. And we just saw it again yesterday in the House of Representatives. That was for all practical purposes, a filibuster, you know, getting up and walking out. Why they didn't do it. Evelyn, thanks so much for the call, and look forward to seeing you tonight at Borders.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Yeah, that's at 5 to 7 tonight in Reno, Borders Books and Music's on South Virginia in the Redfield Promenade, or is it Promenade? Promenade, probably, shopping center. Nora in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Nora, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I'm extremely concerned about the New Mexico results of their election that they gave out yesterday.
Yeah.
Because they have this lame type of voting with provisional ballots, which we don't have here in Minnesota. We have same-day voter registration.
Right,
and our congressman
states.
Is working on a bill in Congress, Keith Ellison, to try to get the U.S. to come into the modern day and have same-day voter registration.
The Republicans will absolutely not allow it. I mean, there are only 9 states, I believe, in the United States right now that have same-day registration for voting. It's a wonderful and marvelous thing. It enfranchises as many people as possible. It gives the majority of Americans a say in their elections. It's how it's done in most countries around the world, and the Republicans have been fighting this thing tooth and nail, and they will continue to.
Well, so as it turns out on the numbers, because 158,000 voted, only 149,000 were counted as after they checked to see if they had their name on a list. And I think, so in other words, 8,000 were disenfranchised, and she won by less than 2,000.
Yeah.
And isn't this connected to the U.S. attorney firing that they were trying to plan out, the reason why they were trying to set up the correct attorneys in the swing states to have these, to fail to prosecute the other type of voter fraud that they're saying this is because of they can't have let everybody
yep.
vote because
yeah, only
of voter fraud?
Yes, although it's not voter fraud, it's election fraud.
The election fraud.
We need to distinguish between the two. Election fraud is what the Republican Party has been doing forever. And in the 1980s, there's still in force today. There is a federal court order saying that the Republican Party cannot engage in caging. And yet, here you had, I don't know, it wasn't Sarah Taylor, it was the other woman, I'm forgetting her name, who was testifying before the Senate, who said, oh yeah, Tim Cummings, that guy who's Karl Rove's assistant, he was in charge of caging. And nobody said, what? I mean, it's mind-boggling. It's absolutely mind-boggling. What goes on. But the fact of the matter is that if the majority of Americans actually voted, you wouldn't see hide nor hair of the Republicans for a long, long time. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
When Jesus got religion, another new message he was sent to give $1 trillion back to the upper 1%. Some 40 million people here ain't got no health insurer, but the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer. How did this country get so bad now? How did this country get so bad? How did this country get so bad now? I want to know. We tell the world we're going to give them to democracy, but the only thing that they perceive is our hypocrisy. George Bush, he went to Russia, told them they should be more democratic. But Putin said to Bush, shut up, and we know what's in your addiction. How did this country
get so bad? Well, talk to the Republican Party. What can you say? And a few in the Democratic Party as well. 51 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. A lot of folks want to weigh in on this Michigan and Florida thing. Hank in Santa Maria, California, your thoughts on it.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I enjoy listening to you.
Thank you.
I think the leadership council of the Democrats were wrong when they prohibited Michigan and Texas from
Michigan
going early in their primary.
Michigan and Florida.
Florida, I mean, yeah. I disagree with that. However, all the candidates then signed off on it. And now for Hillary to say that, because it would be to her advantage, that she wants to count them, that they would be disenfranchised, is disingenuous, and it smacks of political trickery. It's not an honest scenario.
Yeah, and that was my point, is that whether or not it's honest, I mean, arguably she could build a case for it. I think, in fact, I'll build the case for it, that you know, nobody should be disenfranchised. None of the Democratic voters should not have their voices heard. But the fact of the matter is that because people were told that it didn't count, and because many names, including Barack Obama's in Michigan, were not even on the ballot in the case of Michigan, those voters were disenfranchised, period. And frankly, if Hillary Clinton wants to have the perception, and as well as the reality, that she's playing by the rules and that she plays fair, and that if she wins the nomination, and there's a very good chance she will, that she won it fair and square, then those two states need to have caucuses where the voters of the states can once again assert their will and their preferences. Bottom line.
Tom, that's an idea, but you know what, Tom, that shouldn't even be necessary.
It shouldn't be, but it is now.
What it should be is that they should make the arguments, and the reason why Hillary would support caucusing is because, once again, she would think it would be to her advantage.
Yeah, but the Clinton camp has, or people within the Clinton camp, I believe, the punditocracy is suggesting that caucuses in Michigan and Florida at this point in time would probably throw those states to Barack Obama. I don't know if that's the case or not. Frankly, I don't care. I think that people in those states should have a chance to have their voice heard. Hank, thanks for the call. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. Great to talk to you again.
Thank you.
I heard David Brooks on Diane Rehm this morning basically saying he didn't come right out and say what you just said, that Barack Obama would definitely win those, but he basically gave the impression that it would be a disaster for the Democratic Party. And I just want to refute that wholeheartedly. Basically, what would happen is all of a sudden, in the middle of May, when no campaigning has been done for decades, Florida and Michigan, two of the biggest states in the union, will be paying attention to Democrats and our issues,
yep,
particularly free trade versus fair trade in Michigan, which is going to be huge in Ohio and Pennsylvania. And in my opinion, whether it's Hillary or Barack, whoever takes the strongest stance against fair trade or against free trade and for fair trade is going to win the nomination.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jeff. And I would add that democracy in the United States, the Democratic Party as well, but democracy in the United States is always served by people participating and being allowed to participate. I can't imagine any scenario under which you could cogently argue that having a caucus, a new caucus, in mid-May, for example, it was when I would suggest, yeah, I mean, our Oregon primaries are early, I think the first week of May, it would be right after that, for example, because I think there's enough time to organize it if they got it together right now, that would be a benefit to democracy, to the process, small d democracy, and to the Democratic Party, and to whoever ends up being the nominee of the party, because that person would be free of any taint of, you're the nominee, but, you know, it's sort of like George Bush in the Supreme Court, you know. Richard, Everett, Washington. Hey, Richard. Your thoughts on this, Richard? You are on the air? You are not on the air. Christy in Long Island, New York. Hey, Christy, what's up?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to ask you, I mean, you mentioned the subprime mortgage mess before and deregulation of the business side of it. And I think we're seeing the short term, and I wonder what the long term effects are going to be, because, and I can't stand these Republicans that bring up Reagan, because under him, they deregulated marketing to children. And
right.
I think part of what happened with children's toys over the last year was as a side result of that. There's a lack of overseeing of these products. It's just a push to get them out and make the money.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, I guess I'm relating that because, you know, what I've read about that issue. What's the long term effects of the subprime mess? I mean, I think it can go on longer.
Oh, it is. We're at the leading edge of it, not even in the middle of it. And the far end of it is nowhere in sight, and nobody knows where it's going to go. And all over the world, economists and governments are freaking out, and central banks are freaking out. And frankly, the most probable, in my opinion, the most probable long-term effect is going to be massive deflation. And deflation meaning that money becomes harder and harder to get and becomes more and more valuable. And deflation is what we saw in the 1930s. And that's not a good thing. If companies can't borrow money so that they can conduct business, if people can't borrow money so that they can buy products, then the economy starts to sink. And then you get into the psychology of downward spin, and it's an absolute disaster. And so to try and stave off that disaster, what they're doing right now is they're pumping as much liquidity, as much cash and cheap credit into the market as they possibly can. And the outcome of that would be hyperinflation. I mean, these guys have set up a situation where a whole bunch of people walked off with trillions of dollars in profits, and now the rest of us are stuck holding the short end of the stick.
I'm just a little confused because I thought that kind of goes against what their initial effect is. I mean, they're not interested in long-term profit. They're just interested in short-term get rich quick.
That's right.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that the system got rigged so that the people in the banking industry and in the mortgage industry could make a quick buck, basically. The people who are giving big contributions and donations to the Republicans could make a quick buck. And they would stick, you know, and they would sell these packaged securities to the Chinese and to the Saudis and whatnot. Well, the Chinese and the Saudis are starting to say, thanks, but no thanks. We don't want those securities. Christy, thanks for the call. Great to hear from you. 57 minutes past the hour. Anything goes Friday.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Call 866-303-2270. Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And welcome back to Anything Goes Friday, live from Reno. We'll be signing books this afternoon from 5 to 7, starting at 5 o'clock. 5 o'clock this afternoon at Borders Books and Music on South Virginia in the Redfield Promenade Shopping Center. Broadcasting live today from AM with IQ, Smart Talk, KJFK, 1230 AM in Reno. Our number, 866-303-2270, toll free across the United States. And frankly, most places in the world, you can now dial into a toll-free number. And let's just
keep on going here. Richard in North Bergen, New Jersey. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, good morning. Good afternoon. Excuse me. I took your advice, I guess you'd call it, about the anthrax attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And I called up my two senators, my congressman, and several other senators, including Harry Reid, and I called up Nancy Pelosi's office asking that they have hearings as to the status of the investigation of the anthrax attacks.
Hey, good on you, Richard. And did you hear anything back from any of them? Was this just today that you called them?
Within 5 minutes after I heard you on the radio, I got out my Rolodex and started going through the numbers that I have there.
Yeah.
And calling all the offices directly.
Uh-huh.
And asking that, you know, that we haven't heard anything in 2 or 3 years, and what's going on with this so-called investigation. And I thank you for the sort of bringing that to mind. I hadn't thought about it in a while myself.
You're welcome. Thank you, Richard. And, well, actually, it was a caller who called in. But, yeah, it's something that we need to be bringing up over and over and over again. Because
did
this
you see Keith last night?
Did I? Keith Olbermann?
Yes.
No, I didn't. I was on an airplane here to Reno.
Because he had a, if you go to Crooks and Liars, he has a section on his special comments.
Yeah.
He did one last night that you really got to see.
Okay, I'll check it out. Keith is one of my heroes. He's doing great work on television.
He did a special comment last night in which he called the president a fascist.
Oh, my. Yeah. See, Keith Olbermann, I mean,
it gets better from there.
Yeah. Okay. I'll check it out. Richard, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Now, Keith Olbermann is one of the truly sane and really, truly great voices in television right now. And thank God for him. Bob in Troutdale, Oregon. Hey, Bob.
Hi. With regards to this anthrax attack issue, I'm glad that was brought up. What I was hoping you would do is you spend a little bit more time educating the public on what Operation Northwoods is. I'm sure you know what it is. Mm-hmm. And it's the biggest eye-opening thing I can show people that changes their attitude toward conspiracy talk.
Now, Operation Northwood was the program where they were phoning up the airplane and going to shoot it down, wasn't it?
It was a proposal made by the Joint Chiefs of Staff to the Kennedy administration to begin committing terrorist acts on American soil.
Right. And the first one was, and it was going to look like it was being done by Castro.
Right. They were trying to suck the communists into it so it would create a pretext for war against
Castro.
Communist Castro.
Yeah.
And I would, you know, when I'm trying
and to his credit,
something.
By the way, as I recall, the Kennedy administration said thanks, but no thanks.
Right. And then a few months later, he was shot in Dallas.
Right.
But they were proposing, people can look this up on abcnews.com. They can look it up on Wikipedia.
No, you can easily Google Operation Northwoods. It's not like it's a secret.
And, no, it's not.
And it's probably not the only time that it's happened. And there, you know, and certainly, I mean, you know, from the USS Maine all the way up to the Gulf of Tonkin, there have been, shall we say, fishy situations. But Operation Northwoods was particularly pernicious, along with COINTELPRO, in my opinion, in that it actually targeted Americans in ways that, frankly, could have killed many Americans in order to blame it on somebody else in order to have a war. And to say that it is unimaginable in the United States is simply not true, because this was a serious proposal by the Pentagon. Bob, thanks a lot for raising the issue. I appreciate it. Matthew in Lincoln, Vermont. Hey, Matthew.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. What's up?
It's interesting. I was going to talk about the anthrax thing today. And it's been coming up in your program all day, so I find this really interesting.
It's synchronicity.
Yeah. So I was hoping to talk to my Senator Bernie Sanders, but obviously there's a delay going on, so I'm not talking with him. The anthrax attacks was against Leahy and Daschle, and I think it was to hush them up. Now, there's different ideas of what they were being hushed up about. I believe that we have an illegitimate president who was not elected, who stole the election in 2000, and I believe every election since has been stolen or altered, and I'm upset that the Democrats aren't challenging that enough. And the other thing I believe is that the official 9/11 story makes no sense, and it's not true, and what really happened has been covered up, and I believe this anthrax thing completely ties into that, because I believe Leahy and Daschle were basically hushed up about 9/11.
Well, I think they were certainly freaked out about it, and I want to say, Matthew, you're singing my song. I mean, I am, I am not one of these folks who says, I know what happened on 9/11. It was this. You know, I don't, you know, I spent 17 years investigating who killed John Kennedy, and Lamar Waldron and I ended up writing almost a 1,000-page book with over 2,000 footnotes on it. And, you know, I tracked down old Cuban spies and CIA guys, and I was in, you know, weird, seedy parts of Miami and down in Bogota and all over the world. I mean, the research that went into that book was bizarre and at times really scary. And the book is out now. You know, it's titled Ultimate Sacrifice. And I can tell you, you know, after 17 years, we started out assuming, or at least I started out assuming, that somehow the CIA was tied into it, and ended up with a very different conclusion, although there was, you know, some, the CIA didn't come out of this thing all that clean. But the bottom line is, I think that anybody who thinks that they know all the answers is probably misguided. What we need are serious investigations. And I think the tragedy of this, with regard to 9/11 and this whole thing, is that it's going to probably play out the same way the Kennedy assassination did, and that is that there's going to be some people who, you know, like the early Mark Lanes and folks who are kind of making a living out of it and doing the circuit and talking about it a lot. I'm not condemning him for that. You know, God bless him. He got the word out. And then there'll be some early books on saying, okay, well, what about this and what about this? And there are, and you got David Ray Griffin out there, to, you know, pointing these things out. But it's going to ultimately be individuals like Lamar and I who figure this thing out. And it really should be, well, arguably with the Kennedy assassination, I mean, there was a House Committee on Assassinations did conclude that there was a conspiracy that was more than just Lee Harvey Oswald. But then they just kind of, you know, dropped it at that. There needs to be a serious investigation. You're spot on, Matthew, spot on. It just ain't right. Hey, Claire, Connie in Monterey, California. Hey, Connie, what's on your mind today?
Hi.
Listening, I'm assuming on KRXA there.
You bet.
Great.
The really great station.
It is.
I wanted to talk to you today about the caucuses.
Uh-huh.
I can't understand how come AARP and the people with the law about the people with disabilities aren't at the Supreme Court just hollering and screaming about caucuses. I mean, you know, you've been talking about franchising all voters. And how do the caucuses not disenfranchise a whole bunch of voters like myself? I mean, I'm partially disabled. There's just no way I can get to a caucus and stand up for those 5 or whatever hours it takes to do a caucus. I can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Elderly people can't do that. How does the government rationalize that a caucus gets fair for everybody's vote?
Well, first of all, the caucuses aren't put on by the government. They're put on by the political parties.
Okay, how does
primaries,
the party rationalize
primaries
it?
Are put on by the government. And the parties, it's an imperfect system. Connie, your specific criticism and condemnation of them is well taken, and you're absolutely right. There are some people who can't participate, or for whom it's a significant hardship, shall we say, to participate in a caucus, whereas they could mail in a ballot, or they could even show up and vote and more easily.
Well, it's just not fair. I mean, I
agree. It's not perfect, let's say, but it's better than nothing. And it's not going to be possible that in Michigan and Florida, the states are going to have primary elections. There's no time. They can't do it. They're not. And you'd have to have the cooperation of the Republicans, and they're not going to go along with it. So
you mean the Democrats have to have the Republicans okay to do another primary?
That's correct. Primaries are done by governments. Caucuses are done by parties. So the party pays for the caucus. It's kind of like, you know, let's do it on the cheap. You know, it's like a poor man's way, or woman's, or whatever, you know, not to be too sexist.
Right.
Anyhow, it's a poor way of accomplishing it, but it's better than nothing. And there are actually some positive aspects to caucuses too, particularly early on, because people do have an opportunity to air and the issues and talk about, you know, their concerns about the candidates and all those kind of things in a very public forum. I mean, you could argue in a way that they're even more democratic than a primary with a secret vote, because there's actual discussion and debate going on in a caucus, which is a good thing within a party. But then when it comes down to the vote, you know, that in a caucus, that it gets a little more problematic, as you correctly point out. But I just don't see any alternative for Michigan and Florida right now. Connie, thank you for calling, though, and for pointing that out, and for listening on KRXA. 16.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
già scena, su 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 sale fonghi di dalle da. Anything goes.
And welcome back. Anything Goes Friday, 21 minutes past the hour. And Gene in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Gene, listening on WDTW. What's up?
Oh, hey, Tom. I called Mark Brewer's office this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him that I thought that the Democratic Party should pay for a primary for the whole state.
Yeah, they can't do that. It's just because a primary requires all the apparatus of government to get involved, and so the legislature has to decide that. And as long as there's Republicans to obstruct it, it won't happen. But a caucus can be done simply by the party, and it can be done in people's homes. It need not be all that expensive. That's why I'm saying that they should have caucuses, even though I agree with the last caller that a caucus is less perfect than an election primary, you know, where people's, you know, one person, one vote, and it's just, you know, it's pure and it's transparent. A caucus is not quite like that, but it's better than nothing. And it's better than, frankly, having the states of Michigan and Florida go for either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. Right now they would be going for Hillary Clinton in a way that's going to cause those candidates to appear tainted by it, by a defective process.
Anyway, I also told them that however the popular vote went,
mm-hmm.
that the superdelegates should have to vote that way.
Yeah. Frankly, I think that they will, Gene. And thanks for raising that issue. I'd like to just riff on the superdelegates thing. I think that here's my take on this. And I haven't talked about this much on the air. And although Carl and I get into it a lot on our local show on KPOJ, but the Democratic Party, think of the Democratic Party or the Republican Party for that matter, or the Green Party, any party you want, as a club. Because in many ways it is. And you've got some people who have given their lives to that club. They have, for, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years, in some cases even longer, every 2 years or every 4 years, they've gone before the voters, they've gone before the members of the club, and they've said, I want to continue putting my time and effort into this, I want to continue participating in this club, I'm part of it, and they're really committed to it. And then you've got folks who just joined the club yesterday, literally yesterday, registered to vote as a Democrat. Never been to a club meeting, never been to a Democratic Party meeting, never contributed money, never, you know, nothing. But they're voters. And they should have a say. They absolutely should have a say. But the idea of the superdelegates was to say the majority of the delegates, 80% of the delegates, are going to come from the mass of the people, which ranges from people who have been lifelong Democrats to people who joined the party yesterday. And in many cases, in many states where they have open primaries, to people who are Republicans. They're not even members of the club, or they're independents. But because we're a club, and we're concerned with two things. We're concerned, number one, with good governance for the United States, because we're a political club. It's the party. We also have a second concern, and that is the survival improvement of the club. Making sure that the club is strong, making sure that the club does what it's supposed to do, that it's putting up good candidates, that it's authoring good legislation, sponsoring good legislation, taking reasonable positions. And so we want to make sure that 20% of the people who have a say in who is going to be the head of the club, the nominee of this club, the candidate to run for president, that the people who have really given their lives to this club will have a little bit more of a say. And it's not 1,000 to 1 or 10,000 to 1, like some I've heard some people in the media say, because it's not your vote against a superdelegate's vote. It's your delegate's vote. So you may be one of 10,000 people in a congressional district who vote for a delegate, and that delegate then, you know, is matched against a superdelegate. So and the superdelegates are by and large all elected people, whether they were elected within the party. In other words, are party officers, but they were elected democratically within the party, or whether they were elected by we the people. They're elected members of Congress, they're governors, they're senators, they're the elected officials. So they have gone before the club year in and year out, and said, you know, I'm here, I'm committed. And frankly, I think that that's a healthy thing, that those superdelegates have a say in this. And I also believe that they don't want, because they're part of the club and they're concerned about the future of the club as well as much as any of us are, I don't believe that at the last minute that they're going to say, oh, well, I'm just going to go this way or that because somebody gave me a campaign contribution or because I made a commitment. They're going to do what's best for the club. So, everybody's all hysterical about the superdelegates. I, frankly, am not. I'm not all that concerned about it. I think that ultimately you're going to see that it's going to work out as a good and healthy process. Robin and San Rafael. Hey, Robin, we have about a half a minute here before we got to take a hard break at the bottom of the hour. What's up?
Well, I really have to disagree with you about caucuses and that they're better than nothing. They're completely undemocratic. Older people don't go. Working people don't go. People who need...
What's the alternative, though, in Michigan and Florida? What's the alternative?
Well, in Michigan, they Edwards and Obama took their names off the ballot by choice. That was their choice. And they had a big campaign to have people vote uncommitted. And in Florida, over a million people voted, even though nobody campaigned there except Obama, who ran national ads.
So you think those Democrats should simply be seated from those two states?
Yeah. And I think caucuses, the reason Obama wins caucuses is because students go, they're not working, they have 3 hours to spend, and so do rich, upper-class, middle, white people.
Yeah, interesting. Robin, thank you for weighing in.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You feel bad, but not bad enough. You know you had it coming because you played so rough. Back over your shoulder.
Look out, George. Look out, Dick. Look out, Condi. 34 minutes past the hour. I got a note here from Mike in Seattle. He says, just a note about my Seattle caucus. I had two people in my group that were in wheelchairs. Not a problem. Meeting place was a senior center and handicap friendly. There were some other people in wheelchairs in other groups, as well as some seniors who could not move upstairs. The entire process was 2 hours, counting time to register, and there were chairs if someone needed to sit down. It's the responsibility of the group to have a good place to meet. It's also prudent for someone that is mobility limited to call and ask about access. And yes, a caucus does favor candidates that have highly motivated supporters. So that being the case, I'm just, in my opinion, these two, by telling people your vote won't count, don't bother to show up unless you want to vote about something else on the ticket, on the ballot. My personal opinion, the Michigan and Florida results are not valid, and those two states should redo it. They can't redo it as primaries. That would require the state governments get involvement, and the states are not going to do that. And so the only alternative is for the Democratic Party to sponsor caucuses in those two states. And that's frankly what I think would be the very best thing to do. Anthony in Seattle, you wanted to debate superdelegates with me.
Oh, hey, Tom.
Hey, Anthony.
Well, I actually became the elected PCO for my precinct, and I must say, as far as your last caller and the handicap thing, these chairmen of the legislative districts where they actually held the caucuses had plenty of lead time. They knew how many Democrats would be coming out to vote, so it was incumbent upon them to select a venue that was large enough to accommodate everyone. Unfortunately, we have a total failure of leadership in that. And so, anyway, yeah. I don't want to get off on a rant on that. As far as these superdelegates, let me just say that I am here living in Washington State. Now, our two state senators, Senator Maria Cantwell and Senator Patty Murray, they came out long ago for Hillary.
Right, and they are both superdelegates because they're elected members of the United States Senate.
And they are both superdelegates. And the thing is that they continue to support Hillary as superdelegates, even though our state voted almost 70% to 30% in favor of Obama. So,
right. With the support of your governor, who's also a superdelegate who endorsed Obama, Christine Gregoire. But here's my point, Anthony. I don't have a problem with that because Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray, your two senators, as superdelegates, their job is to do what they think is in the best interest of the party, not necessarily what they think is your will. As a senator, they are elected to represent you. And so if the majority of the people in Washington state say, hey, we want national health care, they should be doing national health care, for example.
Well,
but as a superdelegate, their job is to represent the interests of the party, not the voters.
Well, let me tell you this then, Tom. The majority of Washington state is opposed to this war, as is the majority of the American people. And these two senators, just like Senator Clinton, voted for the war. And they refused, even though there have been massive sit-ins and protests of their Senate offices, and they haven't apologized. Neither has Clinton. These two senators,
those are legitimate areas to hold them responsible. I agree with you on that. And right across the board, politicians. This is the thing in the United States. Our Constitution was not set up for us to elect leaders. It was set up for us to elect representatives, people to represent us. The word is used, and it's very clear. On the other hand, if we want to talk about superdelegates, which is where we began this conversation, their job is not to represent us. Their job is to represent the best interest of the club that they have given their life to, that being the Democratic Party in this case.
So wouldn't on that line of thinking, you have to understand this club that we've attracted all these new members to, if you were to come out, been to the caucuses, you would have seen it.
Yeah.
The thing is that all these people are going to be very, just absolutely mortified if some little in a back room, they decide to select Hillary Clinton as the nominee.
I agree with you, Anthony. I've said it on this program many times. If the superdelegates are the ones who make the decision, and if it's made in a non-transparent way, there's going to be significant blowback, both within the party and at the national election. And that's why I think, frankly, superdelegates, like, let's say that it ends up being pretty overwhelmingly Obama, but not enough to legally push him through, and the superdelegates are going to make the decision. At that point, I would suspect that most of the superdelegates, probably including Cantwell and Murray, although I can't speak for them and I don't know them personally, I mean, both of them have been guests on the program, but you know, beyond that, I would guess that most of the superdelegates who are committed to Hillary Clinton would say, okay, I'll go with Obama. Or the other way around. If after Texas and Ohio and all the way up to the Oregon primaries and in May, if it's looking like it's going to be Hillary Clinton, then those superdelegates who have pledged themselves to Barack Obama will change. Superdelegates are not obligated to hold to whomever they're pledged to. They can vote for anybody on that final day at the convention when the vote is held. For that matter, all delegates can. The delegates that you guys elected can change their mind, although it very rarely happens. It's happened, you know, a half a dozen times in the 20th century. Individual delegates actually voted against. It's the same thing with the Electoral College. The electors of the Electoral College are not required to vote for the person, you know, for whom they were sent. But and there have been two or three instances in the history of the United States where that's happened. But that's, you know, that's the bottom line. So I guess we're, in a way, kind of agreeing on this point, but, go ahead.
I just think that, you know, just like the Electoral College, our system is so screwed up. It's just like, why can they have elections in Africa and all these third world countries, you know, where, you know, they clearly, they vote. They even have a picture of the person on a paper ballot.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like our system is so screwed up. And
I know, and it's screwed up in part because it was the first one. I mean, the founders of this country put together democracy before John Stuart Mill came up with the idea of proportional representation. So we had the winner take all, first past the post. They tried to put together the Electoral College to make sure that small states would be represented as well as large states. You know, without the Electoral College, the two presidential candidates ultimately, or the multiple, you know, whatever it may be, could simply pick, I don't recall the number, but I think it's like 21 or 22 states, which represent an absolute majority of the voters in the United States, and ignore the rest of the United States. They could just campaign in some small parts of the United States, the biggest cities and the biggest states. And, you know, that's not a good thing either. So actually, the Electoral College, because you know, there's more electors, because every state's electors is the combination of their members of the House and Senate, and so small states have a few more electors than large states do, proportional to the number of voters. They have a little more say. I think that that's actually a good thing because it forces candidates to campaign in more states. They still can ignore some states, but it, you know, George Bush has never been to Vermont. But it forces them to broaden their scope. Anthony, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it. It's always good to have a good conversation like that. Eric in Skagway, Alaska, KUDO, our affiliate up in Anchorage. Hey, Eric, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you? Tom, I'm calling. I want to say that I agree with you about 90% of the time, but the one issue that I'd love to talk with you a little bit about, you had touched on yesterday's show, and that is your take on atheism and how you want to call out evangelical atheists and say it's another religion. And just to take it a little bit further, too, how this particular election, the religiosity, if that's even a word, and the bearing that's taking place with all the candidates on that is making a portion of our population fairly disenfranchised. And just wanted to get your thoughts on that and talk
sure.
a little bit about your views on that.
I am of the opinion, and I know that there are many people who disagree with me and many people who agree with me on this. I mean, the email I get is pretty evenly split whenever I talk about it, that... And I realize I'm semantically splitting hairs. I'll put that right up front.
Exactly.
But that agnosticism, people saying, I don't know. I don't have a clue. And, you know, I'm not going to worship anything. I just don't know. You know, that's not a religion. But that there, and many atheists are not members of a religion. They're not organized. They're not evangelical. They're not out there crusading for their cause. But there are also some atheists who are evangelical. There's no other word to describe it. I mean, I've had people corner me and, you know, in ways that would make a Seventh-day Adventist or Jehovah's Witness blush, try to convince me to think the way they think, to spiritually view the world the way they view the world. That's evangelicalism or evangelism. And having a coherent worldview and being evangelical about it, in my opinion, qualifies a person as having a faith, a religious faith. It is a belief system in something that is not measurable. It's not negatively measurable. It's not positively measurable.
Okay, certainly. And I think that we are probably just splitting semantic hairs on this one. It certainly isn't a faith so much as it is, you know, I think...
You have a faith that there is no God, and I have a faith that there is something out there. I'm not sure it's a monotheistic God, but, you know, I incline that way, but I'm perfectly willing to accept even the animus, but, you know, my strong sense is that there is something out there. It does, but neither one of us can prove it to the other.
And, well, here's the issue, though, is that when these things start to get politicized, I'm an atheist, and an unapologetic atheist, and with some of the definitions that are floating around today, I would probably classify myself as an angry atheist, only in that
because
things are getting politicized to the point where, you know, people want to look at us and really
I agree
make
with
us
you.
The outcast.
Yeah,
and
I agree with
all
you totally
is we want
on
to
that,
place at the table.
I absolutely agree with you, and I think that the demonization of atheism is a terrible thing, and I don't condone it. Thank you for the call.
Thanks,
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Now, this is my dad's favorite song. We played it at his funeral last year. Thanks so much to Sean Taylor, my producer, to Louise Hartman, to Chris Rosen, Lauren Kirshner, and Marcus Hellman at Air America, to Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thanks so much. And thanks to Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service, for being with us every day here, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, what's on your mind today?
A lot's going on. First of all, sort of a little noticed thing that's going on. The U.S. Senate Democratic Policy Committee is going to have a hearing. And
Ellen, you're breaking up.
How am I now?
Okay, now we're in a bad cell phone commercial, aren't we?
Right. The U.S. Senate Democratic Policy Committee is going to hold a hearing on February 20th in St. Paul. This is right in the backyard of the senator who is very, very difficult to deal with and who Al Franken will run against.
This would be Mr. Coleman you're talking about.
Exactly, Norm Coleman. And so it's very interesting that they have chosen to do that.
Yeah, it is. It is. What's the fallout from the Republican walkout in the House yesterday?
Steny Hoyer years held a press conference. Hey, I haven't gotten the full on that, but essentially they are saying that they are trying to get bipartisan discussions going on FISA. Try and get something happening with that.
We'll see how it goes and how the political fallout is. Ellen, I'm going to have to let you go because your phone is breaking up really badly. I'm losing about every other word, but thank you for checking in with us, and we will talk with you on Monday. It is much appreciated. Ellen Radner, Talk Radio News, talkradionews.com is the website. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dan in Texas. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Just great. What's up?
I had a comment about, you know, something that came out on Tuesday about Judge Scalia and his comments about slap in the face.
Torture is no big deal, essentially.
And all that good stuff. Yeah. There's a couple of things on the first part and then a little bit on another part that I don't think was paid much attention to. The first thing is that he was saying that the Eighth Amendment, basically punishment, has to do with inmates and incarceration and so forth. So obviously,
right. The Eighth Amendment says there shall be no cruel or unusual punishment.
Right.
And he said what he was suggesting was that means post-judicial process.
Right.
In other words, after somebody has been convicted. But the amendment does not say punishment for a crime.
Right.
It says punishment. And I would argue that if you are picked up on the street for suspicion of something and somebody decides to beat the bejesus out of you, they're punishing you.
Right. Well, the thing is that, you know, on top of that, torture is illegal in many other contexts that the United States is, you know, beholding to and treaties.
Well, and we
so
have
forth.
Laws in the United States that make torture.
Right. And then, but the thing that gets me is that he's pulling out a red herring, because what we're talking about here is also the Fourth Amendment, because obviously if you want to torture somebody, you know, in the ticking bomb scenario to get some information to save somebody, you're going to do that, and there may not be any repercussions except for, you know, our laws against that. But if you're going to then use that evidence to try those same people, you're not only violating, you know, the torture laws, but the Fourth Amendment.
Right.
Because that evidence becomes, you know, the poisonous fruit, so to
right.
speak.
Right. And not only that, it may well be that the information you get is nonsense. Most of the hysterical terror alerts that the Bush administration had us, you know, running through all in 2003 and 2004, particularly running up to the election, all this hysteria, not all of it, but much of it came as a result of the torture of people who simply said anything to
right.
get the torturer to stop, and we're gonna take out the whatever in Los Angeles, we're gonna do that,
right.
and you just stop that, please, you know, you let me breathe, you know, my lungs are filling up with water. It's,
right.
I mean, this is nuts, Dan.
Right.
Dan, I got to move along, but your point is so well taken. Thank you very much for calling and making it. I appreciate it. Sandy, driving in Washington. Hey, Sandy, what's up? Sandy, you are on the air. Sandy, apparently your cell phone is suffering from the same problem that Ellen Ratner's is. We'll go to Jessica in Seattle. Hey, Jessica.
Hi, how's it going?
Just great.
I'll keep this short. I just think that people, in regards to Obama and Clinton, Hillary, questions need to be asked. And I know this is way off the topic, but...
there is no topic. It's anything goes Friday.
That we have such a close relationship with Saudi Arabia, and recently there was a story that this woman is being... convicted to death because other people in Saudi Arabia accused her of being involved in witchcraft.
Yep.
And they want to execute her because of it.
Yep.
The government does.
This is the debate that I had with, I think was it David Horowitz? No, it was Dinesh D'Souza earlier in the week, where I said, you know, what we're at war with is not a particular religion. We're at war with a different era. We're at war with the 11th century.
Yeah,
and we're feeding it.
That day. And I just wanted to bring that up, that... people should, you know, these are some of the questions that should be asked of these candidates.
Yeah.
Of what they're going to, you know, how they're going to handle this. I mean, we shouldn't be shaking their hands when they treat people like this. It's just,
yes, I absolutely agree. On the other hand, what you're going to find is that the candidate's going to be very cautious, at least before they're elected, about talking about Saudi Arabia,
exactly.
who supplies so much of our oil. But you know, how we got ourselves in that mess, Jessica, you can track it right back to Ronald Reagan. Jimmy Carter said in 79 that he was going to make the U.S. independent of foreign oil, and never again will we import one drop more than we did in 1978. And by the year 2000, 20% of our electricity would come from solar power.
anymore. And Reagan came into office and took Jimmy Carter's solar panels off the roof of the White House and brought in his oil buddies to create energy policy and his uranium buddies and his, you know, and we're still subsidizing oil and nuclear power to the tune of billions of dollars. It's mind-boggling and it's horrible.
Yeah, and it's expensive. People.
Yeah, at the expense of all of us. Jessica, yeah. Thanks a lot for
thanks.
Calling and for yeah, and for raising the issue. Well, thanks so much for being with us today. It's been a great day. On Monday, it's President's Day. What would Abraham Lincoln and George Washington think about the state of America today? It's a topic I'm really looking forward to delving into. So be with us on Monday. It should be a lot of fun. Get out there. Get active. Remember, democracy depends upon you. Activism depends upon you. Get out there, get active. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.